Hello, and welcome to Real Talk, where curiosity chases truth. On KVSH 101.9 FM and on voiceofashland.org at your convenience. I'm your host, Susan McCabe. Today, we're going to talk about abolition. Yes, the abolitionist movement of the 1860s officially ended slavery, culminating with Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation. And that's all. History shows us that simply outlawing slavery did not end racism in the U.S. In fact, some might say racism gave multiple forms to the continued enslavement of black people in this country. So there's a burgeoning abolitionist movement underway now. Here to help us understand today's abolitionist movement, fresh off a sold-out event at Fashion Center for the Arts, is artist, activist, and author of the Abolitionist's Handbook, Ms. Patrice Cullors. I am honored to welcome you to the VOV studio, Patrice. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm honored to be here.
You subtitle your book, 12 Steps to Changing Yourself and the World. And as I listened to you last week and moved through this book, a theme emerged in my head. And that theme is, this book is showing us in concentrated form how far our culture has drifted from what's best for humanity and how we can bring it to a point of serving life rather than exploiting it. Am I way off there?
No, that's exactly right. I think with this book, I'm really asking us to look at the ways in which we have allowed for an economy of punishment to be both in our interactions but in how we build systems. And what I mean by economy of punishment, I mean that we rely on vengeance, revenge, and punishment as the way of being with one another. And I actually think that abolition is calling for us to reimagine how we show up for each other, reimagine how we relate to the world. So looking at an economy of care, a world in which human beings and all beings are at the center over profit.
Well, and that kind of brings me to the question of your conversation and how much you talk about capitalism, the patriarchy, and white supremacism, and how do those institutions work together to continue to keep humans down?
Well, I think that, you know, what we watched and witnessed over the last 10 years is a deep challenge to police violence and a deep challenge to the prison system. I've been doing work to undo America's prison system for almost 12, 15 years. And in that work, something that has stood out for me the most is that communities are experiencing a significant amount of trauma at the hands of the state. They're experiencing a significant amount of state violence. And in order for us to deal with that is we have to build a new system. We have to create something that is actually at the center of healing humanity, not just right now, but also healing the past.
I have heard folks say that the criminal, I'm going to put it in quotes, justice system cannot be reformed, but that it has to be dismantled. What sort of system would you envision that would be one of healing for public safety?
I can give a really good example with work that many of us are doing in Los Angeles, Los Angeles City, Los Angeles County in California, which has been a city and a county that has really invested in policing and imprisonment for the last 20 years. But the work of many local organizers and artists has reshaped the county and city, and they have created, based off of community organizers' work, what they're calling a Care First initiative, where they're looking at ways to create more housing, looking at ways to create more mental health clinics, looking at ways to create more space for people to be able to get their needs met. And I think that's what we're really calling for. We're calling for institutions and spaces and places where people can get their needs met.
And hence will not be inclined to commit crimes, presumably. Is it a preventive approach?
Yeah, I think prevention is critical, but I also think when we intervene in harm and violence, there's a way that we can intervene that doesn't further harm and violence. Abolition calls for us to stop violence, stop harm, prevent it from happening, but also understanding that conflicts do happen and harm may happen and will happen because human beings are messy. And when we do cause harm, that there are ways that we can actually take care of each other so that we don't end up causing further harm.
Yeah, the seventh step in your book, which is, by the way, folks, titled An Abolitionist's Handbook, 12 Steps to Changing Yourself and the World. The seventh step to changing the world is committing to not harming or abusing others. And you go beyond the literal definition of harm and abuse. How can the average person apply that commitment in their daily lives when you talk about not perpetuating the system of harm and abuse? How do we do that?
I think one way we do that is by admitting the places where we have caused harm, admitting the places where we have created conditions that could be abusive, where we have been a part of a system that perpetuates harm, and recognizing that and be a willingness to recognize that. And then from there, disrupting it, changing your practice, changing what you do. This is, you know, this chapter is a chapter for individuals, but it's also a chapter for institutions. Think a lot about the institution of policing that has created and perpetuated a lot of harm and violence. And when you understand that that's the institution you've created, you have the choice to make a difference, to change that and to challenge that.
Can you give me an example? How do I do that?
Sure. I think, you know, how one does that is by truly recognizing what is harm, what is abuse. Identifying that, identifying what harm and abuse is, and from there, committing to not acting out in those ways. And if you do act out in those ways, committing to be accountable.
So how do I participate in the perpetuation of, say, police violence? What is it that I, the individual, ignoring or not doing?
Mm-hmm. I think one way for a long time was people ignoring or gaslighting communities and saying it doesn't exist. I think many of us know that police violence exists, and so that's no longer the popular opinion. I think the other way is believing that these systems are reformable. That it's going to be through reform that we're going to be able to change these systems. And in fact, I would challenge and say that it's not going to be reform, that it is going to be getting rid of the systems and building new ones and creating new ones and believing that safety can happen with new systems.
Yeah, that kind of comment is, of course, inflammatory in the white supremacist patriarchy system. How would you go about getting those systems to recognize their own flaws? Is that possible?
Sometimes it's possible for systems to admit their own flaws. I know that when I was doing work around ending the daytime curfew law in Los Angeles City, I remember a judge saying, you know, to young people that the work that he had done had caused a lot of harm, and he wanted to change that by discontinuing the ticketing of young people for daytime curfew laws. And hearing that admission was really healing and important for so many young people. So I think it's possible for systems to admit to harms. I think it's possible. On the other side of that, you know, I think the question is, how do you not go back to committing the same harms? And how do you continue to challenge that?
Do you have answers to that question?
not individually. Some of these answers are for a collective. Some mm-hmm. of these answers are for us to engage as part of a collective conversation.
Yeah, speaking of the collective, a lot of the folks who are hearing this show are uninitiated to the idea of abolitionism. Can you give us a definition of what abolitionism is today and in your lexicon?
Yes. I'll start with saying that I think we all can agree that chattel slavery was brutal, disgusting, unimaginable. And yet we know that when slavery was abolished, there is the 13th Amendment that says slavery is abolished unless you've been convicted of a crime. And so if that is the case, then we still have a duty to get rid of slavery. We still have a duty to get rid of the vestiges of slavery, which is the prison and police system. And so I think the question for this audience is doing really looking at yourself and the role that you play in being a part of this abolitionist movement. I would, you know, really call to action for everyone to join the movement. I think it's a movement that we all can be a part of to stop the incarceration and the punishment and the vengeance culture that we have inherited from slavery.
That brings me to a question about another of your steps. Actually, it was the first step about having courageous conversations. Is that a place that the individual might start in moving away from the culture of vengeance?
Yes. I think that we are all impacted by this culture of vengeance and punishment. We are all, and sometimes we don't even realize it, right? Mm-hmm. Something will happen from somebody else, or we'll be hurt, our feelings will be hurt, and we'll be like, I'm never talking to that person again. They don't deserve to talk to me. And that one action then paints the whole picture for how you relate to that human being. I think what I'm asking for us to reconsider is that human beings are complicated. Human beings are messy, and that we deserve second, third, sometimes fourth chances. Obviously, this all depends on people's safety. I'm not asking people to stay in a harmful dynamic that is impacting their safety. But what I am saying is that we should all be thriving to evolve and change. We should all understand that that human beings have the ability to evolve and change.
And we should not be defined by the worst day of our lives or
That's
the
right.
biggest mistake we've ever made.
That's right.
In your studies and in your understanding of human culture, have humans ever pulled it off to be able to create a society that is founded on love and trusting one another?
Yes. That doesn't mean that mistakes are not made, that harm hasn't happened, that people haven't done terrible things to each other. But what it does mean is that the way forward is a way forward that is centered around love and compassion and truly the dignity of people versus shaming and humiliating them.
Yeah, one of the, I can't remember exactly what chapter it was in, but you were describing the experience of being a little kid in L.A. and walking home from school. Can you describe that, the feeling that you had? Because I think there's a lot of folks out there who haven't had that experience.
Yeah. I grew up in a neighborhood in a community that was heavily policed, that was where that was food insecure, housing insecure, and I often felt like, you know, people outside of my home, as in the government and the state, didn't love us, didn't want to take care of us, didn't want to take care of my mother. And that really impacted how I saw the rest of the world. One, I felt like we deserved more than what we were experiencing. And two, I also felt like we needed to challenge what was happening in our communities, and that our communities didn't deserve to be treated with such disrespect and such disdain. And it would be, you know, as I got older and started community organizing and started doing more public art, where I started to realize that I wanted to see a new system. I wanted to see something different. and that if I lived in a system that was really centered on the love and care and compassion of our communities, then my mother and my family members and the people in my community wouldn't experience what we experienced. And at 19 years old, I took my first workshop on abolition. And when I took that workshop, I knew that I was an abolitionist.
Mm-hmm. Who held that workshop?
It was an organization called Critical Resistance. And Critical Resistance is a national abolitionist organization.
Uh-huh. Yeah, when I read that description of you as a little child walking home from school in fear, not of random violence from the people in your neighborhood, but from the police.
That's right.
And you said the police were unpredictable.
Mm-hmm.
That's an experience that a lot of folks have never had and I think need to hear about. That's the experience that people of color have, much different from the rest of us.
That's right.
White people.
Mm-hmm.
Very moving, very touching. Would you articulate the benefits of abolitionism for people of all colors, including us white folks? Where do you see abolitionism serving all humanity? How would that happen?
I think abolitionism gives us the opportunity to imagine a different world, to imagine a world where we are all in better relationship to each other, to imagine a world where we're not relying on suspicion as a way to be in connection. I think abolitionism allows us to imagine a world where we all are interested in taking care of each other.
That's new, yeah. How do you care for yourself? You've been doing this work for 20 years,
mm-hmm.
and you're a kid still. You're really not very old. How do you manage to keep yourself healthy, sane, safe?
I spend a lot of time with family and friends and community that make me laugh. I have an excellent therapist, and I keep showing up even when it's challenging and difficult.
You talk about creating abolitionist space. Could you describe for us what an abolitionist space might look like?
Yeah.
How would it feel?
I think an abolitionist space is a place where people are coming to the table intentionally to practice the tenets of abolition, whether that's transformative justice, healing justice, whether that is mutual aid, and creating more and more room for us to be our best possible selves.
Our best possible selves. See, again, I'm hearing a prescription for humanity. And of course, humanity is not doing so well these days. Does that extend beyond humans? I'm kind of a fanatic about the environment and climate crisis. And I think that particular issue is intersected with the idea of abolitionism. How would you see that?
Yeah, I talk about it in the book. You know, when we think about the fight for water rights, we think about the fight for different communities and who ends up upholding those fights and the climate crisis. I think about the U.S. military and the role it plays in furthering the climate crisis. I think about the people who work for big corporations to go into courts and lobby against what is best for the climate and what's best for the planet. This is all connected to abolition. Our relationships to the courts, our relationships to policing and the military, it's all deeply connected.
What about the notion of the fact that 1% of the humans on the earth are actually running the show, the whole idea of autocracy and oligarchy, which tends to be spreading. What can the rest of us do about that? How can abolitionism serve that?
It's hard. It's a hard question because it's so big. But I think we're watching, you know, Amazon workers unionize after being union busted and after having experienced one of the richest people on the planet try to stop their union, and yet they were still able to create it. I think we have to keep supporting organizing, keep supporting workers, keep supporting people who are at the front lines of their of making change.
And at the front lines of caring for us, for instance, during the pandemic.
That's
that kind
exactly
of thing.
Right.
You came here to Vashon Island and have spent some time with us doing workshops with our students and in art classes, and we're so grateful for that. I'm looking forward to the ripple effect that's going to have in
Thank
our
you.
Community. You left us with a message in neon outside the Vashon Center for the Arts, and that message is abolition is. What do you want us to do with that?
Mm-hmm. Well, the message is abolition is dot, dot, dot.
Yeah.
And it's important, the dot, 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 because I want the island and people who visit the island to really think about what abolition is and how it is maternal health, how it is transformative justice, how it is healing justice, how it is the fight for students in Los Angeles who are trying to fully defund their police department, and other students across the country are trying to fight police, the role of police on their campuses. Abolition is a fight for a fight to challenge the climate crisis. So abolition is so much, and I see it as a call to action, this beautiful neon that is here at the VCA.
You call yourself an artist along with being an author and an activist. How do you see your art, what form is your art going to take going forward in behalf of abolitionism?
I'll continue to do powerful work, especially with my local art organization and gallery called the Crenshaw Dairy Mart, that is working on building out vertical gardens for communities impacted by state violence and police violence and houselessness. So we've already had our first community garden go up at the Hilda Solis Care First Village, which is a village for people who are in need of housing. It's about 252 participants who get access to this garden, and we'll be doing more gardens throughout the county, as well as the work that I'm doing in Hollywood Entertainment to create films and TV that's at the center of abolition.
Anything coming out soon?
No, not right now. I mean, this was a big project of mine, this Abolition is Neon sign. So this is the offering I give to folks, and then I'll be cooking up my next work.
And we will be looking forward to what that might be. Folks, we're talking with Patrice Cullors. She is activist, artist, and author of 12 Steps to Changing Yourself in the World, an Abolitionist's Handbook. You've written a couple other books, too. What are they?
My first book was When They Call You a Terrorist, a Black Lives Matter memoir. I have an adult version of that and have a YA version of it. So I have three books.
So is one of the adult version not acceptable for kids? Is that the bad words?
Yes, it does have bad words, but also so does the young adult version. So the young adult version is adapted and has a series of questions at the end and has pictures and it has notes and journal messages from when I was in my teenage years.
And that wasn't all that long ago. And I note in your book that at the end of each chapter of each of these 12 steps, you offer guidance, guiding questions. And I'm just going to pull one out here. This was at the end of the chapters of forgive actively, I believe is what it called. Is there anyone in your life you want to forgive, but you don't know how to? What do you understand about forgiveness and its role in your community and family? How would you answer that?
I think that this was the hardest chapter for me to write, because the way forgiveness has been taught to us is you forgive in a way that doesn't actually count yourself and what has happened to you. And so I'm actually calling for an active forgiveness, a forgiveness that is, yes, about forgiving the other person, but also a forgiveness that is releasing yourself of the feelings of angst and anger that might come with resentment from a lack of forgiving.
Thank you, Patrice Cullors, and we'll close on that note. And thank you, dear listener, for listening to Real Talk. I'm Susan McCabe, your host, here with you on Tuesdays with Curiosity to Chase Truth.